It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangechamps. Sometimes writing is a political act. Okay. How are you? How are your family and friends in Ukraine?
How am I doing? I'm not doing incredibly well, no.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do my best.
Days after the Russian army invaded Ukraine, when the whole world was trying to make sense of what was happening and how to respond, these words started circulating online. We lived happily during the war.
We lived happily during the war.
And when they bombed other people's houses, we protested.
But not enough.
But not enough. We opposed them.
We opposed them, but not enough.
But not enough. This is the beginning of a poem, a now famous poem, by Ilya Kaminsky, the Ukrainian-American poet. His is the voice many of us turned to again and again during those first weeks of war, when it was becoming clear that what was at stake in Ukraine was not only the future of one country, but a certain set of values or ideals. Democracy, self-determination, freedom of expression. And Ilya Kaminsky is a writer with a deep personal understanding of the political power of poetry.
Well, when people are powerless for so many hundreds of years, language becomes a weapon. Wheat is a weapon because that's what you have. You may not have guns. In fact, Ukraine doesn't have the guns to close the sky, and nobody is willing to do it, but people still have language.
A few things to know. Ilya Kaminsky grew up in the city of Odessa in Ukraine. He lost most of his hearing at age 4 during an illness. When he was 16, his family moved to the U.S., and that's when he learned English and began writing poetry. So, he is a very accomplished lip reader with an accent. Lean in and listen closely, because his words are so worth it.
We lived happily during the war. We lived happily during the war. And when they bombed other people's houses, we protested, but not enough. We opposed them, but not enough. I was in my bed. Around my bed, America was falling. Invisible house by invisible house by invisible house. I took a chair outside and watched the sun. In a 6 month of a disastrous rain, in a house of money, in a street of money, in a city of money, in a country of money, our great country of money, we forgive us, lived happily during the war.
That is such a scathing and beautiful poem.
Thank you.
What would you like readers to take from it?
What do I want readers to take? Well, in a poem, one hopes to create an experience in the reader. In this case, the hope of the poem is to help the reader to see their own complicity. I do kind of see irony that the citizens of American Empire are showing so much concern for the victims of the Russian Empire while America is regularly bombing other people's houses. And all the while it uses police brutality against its own citizens. Right this very moment. Who remembers Chechnya right now?
Yeah.
Putin used ballistic missiles to bomb the capital of Chechnya, the city of Grozny, into the ground around 1999-2000. The West shouted about it for about 5 minutes. And then we forgot. Why? Because oil and gas companies make money and their dealings with Putin. If we follow the dollar sign, we will see the root of the problem. Our country of money, the poem says. Our great country of money.
Yeah. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately, as I sit in the middle of one empire, the United States, and watch another empire, Russia, invade a small country, it seems to me that language and poetry in particular have always had something to say to push back against empire. You told a story of, it was in an essay you wrote in 2017, but I read it recently, about a poet and friend of yours, Boris was his first name. I'm sorry, I don't remember his last name.
Yeah, Boris Khersonsky is a wonderful poet from Odessa. Boris and Lyudmila Khersonsky, the husband and wife, and they're both poets. Very interesting thing happened in 2014 when Russia first invaded Ukraine. Boris Khersonsky at that time was the most known and beloved Russian language poet in Ukraine. And he said in public that today I am not going to speak Russian, I'm going to speak Ukrainian. And he began writing poems in Ukrainian. Wow. So it's amazing that a poet would refuse his own language. The story of his wife, in some way, Lyudmila Khersonsky, is even more interesting. Lyudmila Khersonsky was born in the country of Moldova. So Ukrainian was never her language. She had to learn Ukrainian in order to write poetry in it. Imagine if here in the United States, when our unfortunately President Donald Trump began to build a wall to separate the United States from our neighbors in Mexico, what if most American poets say, I refuse to speak English. I'm going to write poems in Spanish from now on. I'm going to learn a new language as protest. Just imagine that. It's an amazing thing to imagine, right?
Oh. Why is war the subject that you keep writing about or keep coming back to?
Up until I was 16, most of my childhood and adolescence happened when Soviet Union was falling apart. Watching the country fall apart prepares one to be alert to crisis. It was a time when the door to our apartment was set on fire because we were Jews. Hmm. Ukraine is a complicated place. Ukraine is also a place that is full of hope, especially the new generation of Ukrainians. They are more democratic than Western democracies. Or rather, they believe in democracy more than Western democracies do. They're very idealistic in a beautiful way, and they're prepared to fight for it.
Well, I'm so interested to read that you've been in touch with a lot of poets throughout this war, and you asked one poet what you could do to help, and he said, just send more poems because we're starting a literary journal. And I thought, they're starting a literary journal in the middle of a war? That's remarkable. But then when I thought about it, I thought, when else would we need poetry but during a war?
Well, the person that you're referring to, his name is Yevgeny Golubovsky. He is in his 80s. He is a journalist. Mm-hmm. All the way back to the middle of the 20th century, he met the widow of a poet, Osip Mandelstam. Her name was Nadezhda Mandelstam. Osip Mandelstam was a legendary poet who wrote a poem against Stalin's government and was sentenced to Siberia, where he died.
Yeah.
And his work was prohibited for decades. And so this man, Golubovsky, met Nadezhda Mandelstam, who gave him the copy of the poems written on cigarette paper. And he ended up working for a newspaper, and he published the poems. And the beautiful thing is, he's still here now. And he is starting a writing group for young people because he knows that it matters, that it does change. So yeah, that's a kind of human chain that we create, reciting words to each other sometime. Will that stop Putin? Maybe, maybe not, but it will help us to continue.
Does poetry give us some kind of speech, or can poetry say things that other forms of language can't? I mean, is that part of what makes poetry the thing we turn to so often during times of crisis, when it feels like what we're feeling or what we're going through, we can't somehow use ordinary language to express it? Poetry becomes the language that we use to break up whatever is frozen in us, whatever we cannot adequately express. But I don't know why poetry has the ability to do that.
Oh, I think you're beautifully answering your own question. I can only add to it by saying poem is a spell. It casts a spell on us. It's a memorable speech that we remember when things get difficult. And that memorable speech offers us a balm, offers us a way to go on. You can't recite the whole novel of 400 pages, no matter how wonderful it is. You can't recite it to a person sitting next to you by heart. But you can a poem. It's a kind of a moment of awe, a moment of silence that we carry from one human body to another, that we transport by means of language.
And that's so beautifully phrased, Ilya. I'll just ask very simply, what keeps you writing now in the dark times?
I'm afraid on this planet there are always dark times. The question is whether or not we shut our eyes to them. The dark times happen all the time. Some people unfortunately have to go through wars, but we all lose parents, right?
Yeah.
We all see tragedy in one way or another. We all die. We don't get not to die, right?
Yeah.
The answer to this question was given by Brecht, Bertolt Brecht, a great poet of German language, who protested Nazis and was living in exile when he wrote a little poem that went as the following. And in dark times, will there be singing? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times.
And in dark times, will there be singing? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. That is so beautiful. Ilya, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you, and thank you again for having me today. I'm grateful.
It's been such a joy. Thank you. Ilya Kaminsky is a hard-of-hearing, USSR-born, Ukrainian-Russian-Jewish-American poet, critic, translator, and professor. He's best known for his poetry collections Dancing in Odessa and Deaf Republic. In 2019, the BBC named him one of 12 artists who changed the world. Coming up, writer Bernardine Evaristo remembers growing up as a young black girl in Britain.
It was a very white area that I grew up in. Britain was much whiter than it is now. It didn't make me feel that I belonged.
Finding her voice and winning the Booker Prize.
All writing is political.
That's next on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
So, Bernardine, I was hoping you could start with reading the manifesto. I would love to hear it in your own words.
Certainly. There is a manifesto in each one of us, emerging over the course of our lives, changing and reconfiguring through our experiences. This is mine.
For Bernardine Evaristo, the personal is always political. In 2019, she became the first Black woman to win the Booker Prize for her novel Girl, Woman, Other. And since then, she has been tireless in using that fame to support other artists and writers of color, in particular by publishing undiscovered Black British writers who might otherwise never be known. Her new memoir is called Manifesto, on Never Giving Up. So that's where Shannon Henry Kleiber asked her to begin.
Be wild, disobedient, and daring with your creativity. Take risks instead of following predictable routes. Those who play it safe do not advance our culture or civilization. A wise person chooses partners who will support their creativity and gets rid of those who will undermine, sabotage, or even destroy it. Personal success is most meaningful when used to uplift communities otherwise left behind. We are all interconnected and must look after each other. Society operates via powerful and often impenetrable networks that uphold its tribal hierarchies. So we must establish our own systems as countermeasure. We must pass on what we know to the next generation and express gratitude to those who help us. Nobody gets anywhere on their own. The ancestors are swaying silently behind us. The dead souls of the once dearly departed, who are the reason why we came into being, we must remember them.
I love your confidence in your memoir and your life, and I was just struck by how so many artists second-guess themselves and just take rejection and sock it away, and I just loved your joyful tenacity. Where does that come from?
Yeah, because the subtitle of the book is On Never Giving Up. I think it has multiple sources, really, that tenacity. I was born into a tenacious family. I come from a mixed marriage. My father was Nigerian, my mother English, and they married in the 1950s in the face of huge social and family disapproval, especially on my mother's side of the family. And yet they loved each other, and that was it. So they were going to get married, and they did, and they had 8 children in 10 years. And so my mother's mother really objected to the marriage between my parents, but she also objected to the number of children that my parents had. So they were people who followed their hearts and led the life that they wanted to lead. And that was also the story of my childhood, that my parents had married in spite of the pressures against them. And perhaps that then is the source of my own tenacity.
In your childhood, you write about this period of time where bricks were being thrown through your window on a regular basis, and your father kept a hammer on the side of his bed. And I just think that must have been so frightening. Can you tell me about how you felt at that time? How old were you when that was happening?
It was happening in the 60s. Obviously, it was a very long time ago, but it is something that definitely marked my childhood. It made me feel that I was not accepted in the community in which I grew up. It was a very white area that I grew up in. Britain was much whiter than it is now, but also the area I grew up in was a particularly white area. It didn't make me feel that I belonged, and it made me feel that people were hostile towards me. And I think when you're a little child, that's very disturbing and very sad, because you're just a child, you're innocent, you haven't done anything. and yet people are expressing this violent anger about your very existence.
And your parents became activists. Did that influence you in your activism?
I think, yes, definitely. They were left-wing, socialist, and very active in the trade unions where they worked. My father was a local political figure in the area I grew up in, the Borough of Greenwich. Political conversations were had around our table when we had meals and so on. And also, as I said, I think when you're growing up in a racist society and you're a person of colour, I think you do have a choice as to whether you're going to be somebody who fights against that or whether you're going to be somebody who just gets on with your life and tries to keep your head above water and but not put your head above the parapet. And my parents were people who put their heads above the parapet. And as soon as I was able to, when I went to drama school, which was a very political drama school, I too did that. You know, I became somebody who was prepared to stand up for what I believed in, which at that time was around race and feminism.
And what you were doing in the theater was activism. The stories are so interesting about how there were no roles for Black women. And instead of giving up, you created them. You created a theater company. You created the roles. You made it happen.
That's right. And at a time when nobody was interested in us as Black women, you know, we were in our early 20s. We were theater school, drama school graduates. We realized there was no work for us out there. And so it made absolute sense for us to create our own theatre company, and we called it Theatre of Black Women. We were forging a theatrical identity for ourselves in a very racist society. I was quite a hothead. Myself and my friend Patricia, who was one of the co-founders of Theatre Company, we used to go to theatre a lot. And as I said, the theatre was very white. And when it wasn't white, it was very male. And so if we objected to something on political grounds, we would heckle very loudly and disrupt shows, basically. And we would position ourselves at the back of the theatre so that we could make an easy escape. You know, I grew out of that quite quickly. But when I do think about it, I am slightly outraged because I would never do that now. But if we found something offensive on political grounds, that was all we had at our disposal. You must remember, especially for younger audiences, that there was no social media, there was no Twitter, there was no internet, you know. We had our voices and that was it.
Your novel Girl, Woman, Other is so innovative in form and art and punctuation and groundbreaking in so many ways. It's 12 characters, 11 women and one non-binary character. How do you describe the book?
I call it a fusion fiction in terms of the form of it because it fuses different stories together, and also the way I've used the language on the page. It is a book that is, in a way, an ode to Black British women. And it's a book that travels over well over 100 years. So that it's like a tapestry.
And then it won the Booker Prize in 2019, which is the pinnacle, of course, and something you'd hoped for, as you write in your memoir, but it's hard to say it out loud, but something that you had actually really said out loud to yourself, at least. You have said it wasn't an overnight success, obviously, but that everything changed overnight. So what changed?
Everything. So
yeah.
Girl, Woman, Other has sold well over a million copies in the English language alone. And compared to the sales of my previous books that were often critical successes, but they simply did not sell beyond a few thousand, the reach of my work has just exploded. And then how everybody saw me changed. The image of me as a writer literally changed overnight. And suddenly I was considered a heavyweight. And it's not that anybody thought I was a lightweight before, but I was not. I was often not included in the way that I wanted to be in terms of the literary culture here. And also, I have a huge platform now that I didn't have before as an activist.
Well, there's a long tradition of political writers from Aristotle to Ray Bradbury to Margaret Atwood, and their work is a form of activism and social conscience, and it's a part of history. How do you see your place in this part of ongoing history?
Yeah, I'm very aware that as I'm one of the very few Black British women novelists out there, I am writing our stories into history. I am redressing our absence the absence of our stories in literature in Britain. And if it's not going to be in Britain, it's not going to be anywhere else either. So I'm very aware that I'm making history in the sense, not in the egotistical sense of, you know, I'm so famous, I'm going to make history, but that I am rewriting history and reimagining history through my work, but also as a writer doing what I do, I am also counteracting invisibility.
Do you remember the first time you thought of writing as a political act?
Probably the first poem I ever wrote was about the suffragettes. It was in a school magazine. I lost the school magazine. I went back to my old school last year and they dug it out of the archives and gave me a copy. And it was just wonderful to see it. And I thought, my God, Bernardine, you thought you became a feminist when you went to drama school, but this is such a feminist poem. Back then when I was 14.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is being a political writer different now than being one in previous generations?
The first thing to say is that all writing is political. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously somebody like Margaret Atwood, you know, grapples with the really big issues of the day and imagines our society in ways that are, you know, really dystopian, for example, with The Handmaid's Tale and Testaments. All writing is political. I think, no, when I go back to the writers who inspired me when I was a young woman, when I go back to Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Michelle Cliff, Audre Lorde, they were very political writers in America, and writing Black women's stories into being. That's what they were doing. And they were the first generation to do that in great numbers, actually, anywhere in the world, anywhere in the world.
I'd love to have our listeners learn about your Black Britain writing project. So these are writers who have been overlooked, forgotten, maybe never even known, and you're bringing them back to print. So the publishing business is a very complex and difficult business for many people. But what you're doing with this is really introducing a whole new canon of underrepresented writers into the public. I mean, it's really not an exaggeration to say some of these writers, maybe all of them, would be unknown without this project, and you're giving them a voice and you're giving them a life. Can you tell us a little bit about some of them? Who are you proudest of bringing back into print?
Yeah, so the project's called Black Britain Writing Back, and the idea is to bring back writers that were overlooked or have disappeared from view, going back over 100 years, actually. I think the two books that are sort of standout books in some ways are Growing Out, Black Hair and Black Pride in 60s Britain by somebody called Barbara Blake Hanna, which is an absolutely fantastic memoir about her time living in London in the 1960s. There's also A Black Boy at Eton by Dilibi Onyema, who was the first African, no, take that back, the first Black person to graduate from Eton College, which is the most elite school in this country. It's about 1,300 years old, and I think is probably the most famous school in the world. And he was a student there in the 60s. A couple of years after he left, he wrote a memoir about his time there. It was published in 1972, and it is brilliantly written, but also really shocking in terms of the racism he experienced at this super elite school. The headmaster of Eton banished him from ever darkening their doors again, and the book was kind of trashed by the media. Eventually, he went back to Nigeria, and we've now brought the book back. What I find so interesting about Dilibi's book is that Eton College has produced 20 British prime ministers, including our current one. So it is really the seat of the establishment in this country. It is the hothouse of the elite in this country. And when you read about his treatment as a Nigerian boy at that school at that time, it really makes you reflect seriously on the nature of the people who then went on to run this country in all the kind of most important fields, you know, in the last sort of 50 years or so, because they were the boys he was at school with.
How do you keep going? I mean, you say you're stubborn, and it totally comes through in your memoir that you are not going to give up. But you're experiencing throughout your life racism and ageism and misogyny. Is that what keeps you going, or what keeps you going?
actually, what keeps me going is that I love what I do. That's a really good incentive, isn't it? I love creativity. I've led a creative life all my life. I love writing. Sometimes it's frustrating and a bit struggling and it might not work out for a while, but essentially I love it. I don't know how I would function if I didn't have creative self-expression in my life through my writing and creating other worlds and other stories, you know, because I'm not writing about myself most of all. I'm writing about these other imagined lives. I live in my imagination and it's a wonderful place to be. It's very liberating and exciting and adventurous. And yeah, so that's what keeps me going. Yes, there are always obstacles and definitely obstacles in my past. But if you're doing what you love and also enjoying the result of what you do, so I do enjoy my books. You know, when I finish my books, I don't always think they're great, but when I finish my books, there is such a degree of satisfaction that they are what they are. And I hope they do well out there in the world. But I know I've put everything into them. And it's exciting. Being a writer for me is so exciting. It's a gorgeous job. So that, you know, that keeps me going.
That was Shannon Henry-Kleiber talking with Bernardine Evaristo about her new memoir, Manifesto, on Never Giving Up.
This is like the original buffet.
Writing can be a political act, but so can reading, especially in a post-colonial age.
Well, this Indian teak carving.
Few writers know that as well as Salman Rushdie.
I was born literally 8 weeks before the end of the British Empire. There was a joke in my family which said that, you know, Salman was born and 8 weeks later the British ran away. You know, so.
Maybe the Kiplings left something.
Empires may crumble, but their cultural legacy lives on. As a child growing up in India, Salman Rushdie read the Jungle Books and the Just So stories, classics by another Anglo-Indian writer, Rudyard Kipling. The two men actually had a lot in common: Bombay childhoods, horrible British boarding schools. But politically, they could not be more different.
Did you look at any of these books?
And yet, Rushdie does still read Kipling.
The thing is, for an Indian reader reading Kipling, you have a very double response. On the one hand, many Indian readers would agree that perhaps no Western writer knew India as deeply and as well as Rudyard Kipling did. And his writing reveals that. It reveals the depth of his knowledge. On the other hand, particularly after he went to boarding school in England and had Indophilia, if you like, beaten out of him and came back as a little imperialist, those two things clash in Kipling all the time. And as you read him, you feel that conflict in yourself.
My favorite was The Elephant's Child.
When I was a kid, I loved the Jungle Books. Reading about Mowgli's adventures, I loved them. It was only later, as an adult, that I realized that they contained very racist tropes. The foolish monkeys in the Jungle Books are supposed to be Kipling's portrait of Indian people. When you know that stuff, it reshapes your reading of it.
Don't you want to just go through and, like, open everything?
Yes.
The imperialist Kipling is pretty daunting.
Yes.
He defended the British Empire everywhere, opposed home rule for Ireland. He was friends with Cecil Rhodes and Teddy Roosevelt, two of the most famous imperialists of the day.
Yep.
You know, there's all this talk about certain writers who not only should just be read out of the canon, but basically should be canceled. And it would seem that Kipling might be a suitable candidate for that.
Yeah, I mean, I would defend him against that. It's true, there is all of that, you know. But again, it's one of these things. I want people to read Kipling's imperialist stuff in order to understand what imperialism was like. We can't erase imperialism just because we disapprove of it. It happened, and we need to understand it.
Coming up, if you want to understand someone, there's nothing like visiting their home. So what did Steve and I find in Rudyard Kipling's house?
I just break it.
No, I didn't break it. No. Keep listening. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. It's not often you get to sleep in a museum. But last summer, Steve and I spent a night at the Rudyard Kipling House near Brattleboro, Vermont. It's a classic turn-of-the-century country estate built in 1892 with a slate roof and cedar shingles painted Kipling green. Kipling wanted it to look like one of the luxurious riverboats he'd sailed in India, so the house is long and narrow with lots of mahogany fittings. He called it Naulaka. The Landmark Trust USA owns the place now, and they rent it out. And when you stay overnight, you can sit at the desk where Kipling wrote The Jungle Book, eat in his dining room, even sleep in his bedroom.
It's so funny, you look at all the books and I look at all the pottery.
And while I obsessed over the history and design...
Did you see the chamber pot in our bedroom?
Steve was fascinated by the politics.
There are a few things you should know about Rudyard Kipling. Just over 100 years ago, he was the most popular writer in the world. And to this day, the youngest author ever to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. The second thing, he was an unabashed imperialist. Born in the heart of the British Empire in India, he wrote the notorious poem, The White Man's Burden, which called on the U.S. to colonize the Philippines. He also wrote the beloved children's classic, The Jungle Book, set in the wilds of India. So what was he doing here?
Can I just say it seems really odd that Rudyard Kipling would choose Vermont as the place to settle down?
Everything about his connection to Vermont is odd and wild, and that's when I started getting obsessed with Rudyard Kipling. The idea that that man wrote The Jungle Book right here is just too strange to believe.
Christopher Benfey is a literary scholar at Mount Holyoke College and the author of If, The Untold Story of Kipling's American Years.
So we're in the loggia.
It's a book about how Kipling, the English imperialist, fell in love with America.
I love this house to death. You know, I love everything about it. I think it's the quintessential expression of Kipling's love affair with America.
And how Americans fell in love with him.
It is a spare no expense. Dream house.
Wow. So let's move to this next room here.
So this is Kipling's study at the bow of the ship, at the end of the house where he could be alone, where he could look out on the beautiful rhododendron gardens. This is where the mystery happened. This is where Kipling
wrote incredible books. It's here that he wrote The Jungle Book. It's here that he wrote his American novel, Captain's Courageous. It's here that he wrote many of his greatest poems. He even began Kim. He wrote the first draft of Kim here in his Brattleboro study. So this is really it. One of the things I love in this room is a little inscription that his father left.
Kipling grew up in India and then was sent off to a British boarding school. Later, still a teenager, he went back to India to work as a journalist. He was young and ambitious when he came to America to launch his career.
As Henry James might have said, nauseatingly young. I mean, he was just incredibly precocious. This was a man who wrote The Man Who Would Be King, one of his greatest stories, the story that John Huston made a brilliant anti-war movie of. He wrote it, I think, when he was 20 years old. It's just astonishing how precocious Kipling was.
Other writers were mesmerized by Kipling, who was not only a great writer, but a brilliant conversationalist. There's a story about how he tracked down Mark Twain when he first arrived in America. It took just a single conversation for Twain to say later, "I believe he knew more than any person I had met before."
American writers were a little intimidated by this fluency. They'd never heard anything like it. We have both Mark Twain's report that he was just astonished by the very young Kipling.
And Henry James himself, didn't he say that Kipling was the most complete man of genius he'd ever met?
Yes, exactly, the most complete man of genius. And Henry James' brother, William James, who actually came to Naulaka and stayed with the Kiplings and worshipped Kipling, wrote to his brother Henry. This was a little mean of him to tell Henry this, but he said that he thought that he, William, thought Kipling was more like Shakespeare than anyone else of his generation. No, I mean, Kipling was a sensation. There was no writer of his time who was such a big deal in the United States. And you can't read very far in American literature and culture of the 1890s without running into the name Kipling. From about 1889 to 1890 to 1891, Kipling suddenly is world famous. He's able to command incredible prices from magazines and book publishers. His books are selling like hotcakes. Everyone wanted to get the next book by Kipling. Well, should we wander upstairs?
Yeah, let's, yeah.
I wanted to take you up to the billiard room, another sacred space.
The billiard room, which is modeled on Mark Twain's game room.
This is a little world for men to retreat after dinner to the billiard room.
And I'm wondering where the bar is for the drinks.
Yes.
Everyone visited Kipling. Famous writers trekked up here to play golf and tennis, to stay up late talking politics. But those politics and his circle of jingoistic friends like Teddy Roosevelt are why Kipling, for all his fame 100 years ago, has been practically written out of the literary canon.
Kipling's most notorious piece of writing is called The White Man's Burden. It is a very frank invitation to the United States to take up the burden of empire and occupy the Philippines.
He referred to colonizing the uncivilized people as, he called them, half devil and half child.
So as I said, there are lines, there are lines in the poem that are unbearable, and George Orwell said it should have been called The Black Man's Burden. You know, that the real burden this poem describes is having white people on our backs. Kipling was an imperialist. He was a believer in empire, just as Teddy Roosevelt was, just as many, many men and women of his time were. And you know, I think our challenge with a writer like Kipling is not to find ways to defend him, but to try to understand him. To try to understand why so many Americans were in love with the idea of having their own empire. It's been a temptation to the United States for all of its
existence, and especially in this period after around 1890. But there is another side to Kipling. Kipling understood what the costs of empire were. One of the greatest anti-imperial stories is The Man Who Would Be King.
So he was both an ardent defender of empire, of the British Empire, and yet he saw the problems with it?
Absolutely, yeah. Kipling had seen the workings of empire close up. He had grown up reporting on conditions in India. He knew how things could go wrong. And I think most of Kipling's commentators have felt that this is a very complicated person with not just two sides, but 9 or 10 or 30 sides.
Benfey tells a story about an argument Kipling had with his friend Teddy Roosevelt. Both loved animals, and Roosevelt was helping to build the National Zoo, so they went to visit it together.
Teddy Roosevelt wanted to show Kipling the bears, the grizzly bears. And Kipling said, you know, I'm really interested in the beavers. So you have this wonderful contrast between Roosevelt, who likes big, strong, terrifying animals, and Kipling, who likes business-like, well-ordered builders who are loyal to their families and so on. And there's another contrast. Kipling is very interested in Native Americans, and Teddy Roosevelt despised the Indians, wanted them eradicated. And the two of them got into a shouting match at the Smithsonian, where Kipling was saying, how could you exterminate all your Aboriginal peoples? And Teddy Roosevelt is slamming the glass cases and explaining why they had to be, you know, killed. So very interesting contrast.
If there's one book that's often considered Kipling's masterpiece, it's the novel Kim, the story of an orphan street kid in India who ends up spying for the British Raj. It's a book about what Kipling called the great game, the secret power plays between the British and Russian empires. Long after Kipling died, Kim took on another life as a kind of manual for the U.S. architects of the Vietnam War. Here's Chris Benfey again.
It's the damnedest thing. Kim was a kind of cult book in the CIA. One CIA director after another would sort of hand over Kim to his successor, and the book was required reading among new recruits, and even the particular training methods in the book, memory games and ways of training people to notice clues, to pick up evidence, these were also shared. So in some bizarre way, Kipling's Kim, which is partly about the destruction wreaked by the great game, becomes a kind of handbook for operatives, first in the Philippines and then in the Vietnam War. It's just, you can't make these things up.
What was it that people found useful or important about Kim?
Yeah, I think for John F. Kennedy's generation of, I hesitate to call it white man's burden thinkers, but essentially they thought they could remake the world according to their own designs. Kim was about the adventure of remaking the world. It was about the sexiness of it. It was about the excitement of it. And a lot of that comes out of Kim.
Well, one other thing that I found surprising is the admirers of Kipling's writing. You have the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci. You have Bertolt Brecht, the German radical playwright. Edward Said, the great theorist of post-colonialism. He thought actually very highly of Kim.
These are some of the facts about Kipling that kept me going. As my friends and colleagues said, are you out of your mind to be working on the most politically incorrect writer in the whole canon? Gramsci is a fascinating case. You know, he said, if the great poem, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blame it on you, the, you know, Kipling's most famous poem, Gramsci said, of course, the context that this poem came out of is colonialism and imperialism. But Gramsci said, you know, there are a lot of lessons here for revolutionaries. So again, no matter what we think about Kipling, he can't be erased from our literature. He's just too big a figure.
Rudyard Kipling ended up living in Vermont for only 4 years. It was paradise, but paradise has a way of crumbling. Kipling had a series of run-ins with his brother-in-law, who lived nearby, which turned into a really nasty legal battle. Soon, flocks of reporters were hounding him, so Kipling and his family ran away to England.
He only returned once in 1899. It was a total disaster. He got sick on the crossing over. His whole family got sick. And little Josephine, who he referred to as his American daughter, who had an American accent, who was the love of his life, little Josephine died at age 8, the tragedy of his life. And Kipling said, after this, I can never be in the United States again. And that was that.
Yeah. And there's another family tragedy that happened later. His youngest child, his son, went off to fight in World War I.
John was in a trench at Loos, and the first day he was facing battle, he was blown to bits by a German shell. And that was the end of Kipling's jingoism. That was the end of his notion that fighting was a good thing. And he wrote another if poem, one of my favorites of Kipling's poems. It goes, "If any ask us why we died, tell them because our fathers lied."
Wow. So again, very complicated.
Two sides, always two sides with Kipling.
Christopher Benfey is the author of the book, If, the Untold Story of Kipling's American Years. He was talking with Steve Paulson at Naulaka, the Kipling House in Dummerston, Vermont. The Landmark Trust USA owns the place and rents it out, so you too can stay there. You'll find photos and information on our website at ttbook.org. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, in the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Shannon Henry Kleiber produced this hour, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Angelo Bautista, and Mark Rickers. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. If you'd like to get a look behind the scenes, subscribe to our weekly newsletter at ttbook.org/newsletter. And as always, thanks for listening.